Ahoy, Mets fans. Welcome back to Today Your Love, Tomorrow the World Series. My name is Brian. With me, as always, is Chris. And Chris, it's been about a month since we recorded. You were in Iceland. I'm very jealous. I got a lot of snow in New Jersey, so that's kind of the same. But, you know, the Mets have more or less finalized their roster for opening day, or finalized the pool of players who will make up the roster for opening day. You know, we know that Francisco Lindor had intimated that maybe there's still more work to be done during spring training, and that's always a possibility. But I would think we have to sort of operate under the assumption that we are looking at the roster that will be there on opening day, at least in broad strokes, you know, more or less. And you did a lot of writing this offseason about the Mets bullpen and the people who might make up said bullpen. And did you do six parts of that series, maybe?
I think it would have been eight.
Was it eight? Jeez. Okay.
yeah.
Regardless, the Mets did bring in a lot of players, you know, to mix and match to make up a bullpen. So before we talk about the individual players, as our resident bullpen aficionado of the offseason, what do you think of the Mets bullpen going into the start of spring training this week?
It's in a lot better shape than it was at any of the previous points that we talked about it or that I wrote about it. I don't think it's going to be the best bullpen in baseball by any means, but it definitely starts to look like a capable major league bullpen, which in the bigger picture, I don't know if that's enough to make the team significantly better. But after spending, 3 months looking at roster resource and just going Edwin Diaz, Brooks Raley, depending on your feelings of Drew Smith, and then a whole lot of question marks. There are still question marks there, but I can look down that list and say that there are several major league relievers who are in the mix. And we can touch on, you know, some of the individuals, especially the newest ones who have been brought into the fold. But there was an argument a couple months ago to be made that maybe Jorge Lopez was the third best reliever on the team, possibly, if you believed in the stats that he put up 2 years ago and were willing to sort of, I don't know, overlook or otherwise dismiss his very bad stats in 2023. But that the fact that you look at the depth chart now and obviously in spring training, there will be, you know, injuries, hopefully none major, but inevitably there's some minor injuries or aches or whatever that might have an effect on who makes the opening day bullpen, whether or not a guy has options remaining or is on the 40-man roster at all. There's a lot of things that come into play, but it's not so top heavy. I mean, Edwin Diaz is still by far the best in this bullpen, but that would be true in almost every bullpen in baseball.
Yes.
You know, David Stearns was asked about, I think the question he spoke either on the day that pitchers and catchers reported or the day after, but he was asked a question by someone in the media room there. Do you think Edwin Diaz can get right back to what he did in 2022? And I thought his answer was pretty reasonable, which was, I think he can be excellent, but that was an historically great season. So, you know, matching that would be hard for anybody to do. I'm paraphrasing here, but I will say, so overall, no longer a dreadful looking bullpen, and no offense intended to all the arms they brought in. I mean, they spent, I don't even know if I can assume they spent a lot of time, but they certainly brought in a lot of arms early in the offseason. All various levels of intriguing, some some I can really see, like, okay, here's what they do well. Maybe they can just focus on that and harness that and turn this guy into, a major league relief pitcher. But I'm glad that it's a little bit more solid than that. Any particular thoughts on your end on the specific new, old but new in the case of Adam Ottavino coming back?
Well, one of the things that I had talked about, we had done a sort of a group piece on Amazing Avenue last week about a vibe check coming into the season. And one of the things I talked about was that I think David Stearns was able to look at the team from an outsider's perspective and hopefully bring in some players who he feels would fit that team well. And, you know, he's a guy who's worked with a budget his entire career. And so these were not huge signings. But if you look at the way Stearns has built his bullpens in Milwaukee, this is how he did it, essentially. He would always bring in a lot of players to all fight for roles and a lot of reclamation projects and people who are, you know, considered washed up or considered, you know, issues for one reason or another. And I don't mean issues like, you know, problem people or anything. Just you know, players who weren't considered top tier relievers. And he built effective bullpens out of those type of players. So I feel like there is a little bit of precedent here to trust the dude and his process. In addition, guys like Jake Diekman and Shintaro Fujinami are guys that I think Fujinami is a really interesting case. He's only had one season really in the majors. It didn't go all that well when he was starting. He did better as a reliever. So, you know, there's always that period of adjustment for Japanese pitchers. You know, we got spoiled with Kodai Senga last year, seemingly coming over and not missing a beat. That doesn't really happen. So I think Fujinami could be a perfectly cromulent reliever without too much trouble. Diekman is somebody who walks a ton of people, but kind of limits the amount of scoring that happens against him. So that might be a frustrating pitcher to watch, but the results historically have sort of been there. You know, you mentioned Jorge Lopez already. You know, there's guys coming back like Grant Hartwig and Phil Bickford and possibly the ghost of Sean Reed Foley, Drew Smith. You know, I'm not as excited about those guys, but I also think that with a new organization, with a new front office being built, there'll be new organizational philosophies, and maybe the stuff that people saw in Drew Smith just wasn't happening because the Mets front office wasn't prioritizing whatever they need to make Smith a better pitcher, you know, whether that's pitch selection or was he tipping pitches and someone just noticed it. You know, there's so many things, especially with bullpen arms. They're so fungible. You just never know what's going to happen from year to year. So, you know, I'm not shocked at the amount of pitchers they brought in. Do I wish there was one or two more that felt more like, a steady, I can definitely rely on this person, situation. I don't know if there's anybody outside of, I guess Ottavino, I feel more confident in, and I'd say maybe Diekman is behind him, but it's still a ton of question marks for me. But I mean, there's enough question marks and enough guys with options, like you mentioned, that there should be a halfway decent bullpen cobbled together from there. And, you know, like we've talked about a million times, there are always relief pitchers available during the season, especially at the break. And so I wouldn't be surprised if they bolster the bullpen in July. And that's the way that these things get built. And I'm cool with it. Like I said, I do wish there was a couple of more sort of people I felt really confident about, but I guess this is what we're going to have to deal with.
That's fair. Diekman, I hadn't realized two things about him. One, he had struggled pretty mightily with the White Sox in a brief stint last year, but then with the Rays, he was excellent.
Yes, he was.
Like his overall numbers for the season look good, and then what he did with the Rays looks really, really good. Obviously, we've seen that we as baseball fans of any variety have seen players go to Tampa and then suddenly just be much, much better. So hopefully that's something that what, you know, whether, and I forget sort of the backstory on it, if there even was one on what exactly he changed, but whatever that was, hopefully it's something that stuck with him, and he can carry it into this season. And also, Jake Diekman makes me feel a little bit old, only because I thought of him as a Philly. It's been almost 9 years since he played a game for the Phillies. I mean, like, I knew he hadn't just played for the Phillies last year, but, you know, he spent 3.5 seasons there.
Yeah.
As a division rival, you notice the guys on those rosters. But, yeah, in the middle of 2015, after he was traded away, he hasn't played anywhere near the National League East. Closest would be a brief stint in the American League East with the Red Sox in 2022. But yeah, it's, I'll go a step further. I'll make everybody feel the pain here a little. Next year, if the Mets were so inclined, they could celebrate the 10-year anniversary of the National League champion 2015 Mets.
Oh, man. Why'd you have to say that, Chris?
I don't know.
Although, to be fair, that will be my 10-year Maison Avenue anniversary.
Oh, there we go.
So that's something to celebrate.
Yeah. But anyway, now is there anything I can do to make everybody feel young again?
Talk about Riz or something? I don't know. What are the kids playing today? No, that's God damn it. All right. Anyway, but yeah, there is certainly some bullpen, you know, hope there at least. Do you have any thoughts about Ben Gamel signing a minor league deal with the Mets?
Nothing too strong. I think the ideal scenario is that he doesn't play for the Mets.
Mm-hmm.
And that, I mean, that would largely be the result of just other players being healthy and good. If Starling Marte is healthy and good, if Jeff McNeil is healthy and good, if Harrison Bader has had a sort of knack for getting injured, but again, there's several outfielders that can fill the outfield with Brandon Nimmo, whether Nimmo's in center or left. And I'm really hoping that Drew Gilbert is kind of knocking on the door either in spring training or shortly thereafter.
Mm-hmm.
That's enough outfield names that I think have a viable path to major league playing time that it's not really a knock on Gamel. It would just mean that things have gone pretty well, that they don't have to dip down and use Gamel. He is out of options. He signed a minor league deal though, right?
Minor league deal with an invite to spring training, yes.
Yeah, but I mean, that under those circumstances, he can start the season in Syracuse since he's not on the 40-man roster. Let me just fact-check myself while I'm saying that. But
that's correct.
And look, he didn't really play much in 2023.
Correct.
So he had been a league average hitter or slightly less than that, but hovering around league average for, you know, a few seasons in a row. Coming into 2023. So if he does end up getting a little bit of playing time, probably not the end of the world, but somebody who I'm just rooting for enough of those other guys to succeed. And I think I've made the point a few times over the course of the off season and late in the minor league season last year, I certainly don't pretend to have as much of a grasp of the entire system as, you know, the minor league crew on our own site or those crews that do the top prospect list throughout baseball.
Mm-hmm.
But I think Drew Gilbert's the real deal. And early in the season, unless let's just assume that Gilbert doesn't make the opening day roster. I think he's good enough that he could have a strong showing in spring training and sort of at least make that a topic of conversation. Mm-hmm. But even if he starts, presumably in Syracuse, I think he's somebody who will have that opportunity to come up. And not that I saw him play 100 times last year, but I got to see him play in person a few times, and there's just something there. And it stood out. It stood out on a team that had a few other, you know, guys who came into last season as, you know, notable prospects. And it's not putting down what anybody else was doing out there. It was just, I loved the way he took him at bat. I loved his swing. Good contact to all fields. You know, whether or not that turns into a 30 home run guy, I don't know. But I think this is somebody who can get on base, hit the ball hard and in the air. And even if it's not a high home run total, if you're looking at sort of somewhere between like a David Wright and a Conforto in terms of what I think the ideal outcome is with him. And look, David Wright was on a Hall of Fame track before his back condition came up. So I don't want to throw that heavy an expectation on somebody. I'm just saying that type of hitter that we saw with those, if you could kind of blend a little bit of Wright and a little bit of Conforto, that's the way he felt to me. So one, I hope I'm right, because that'd be a really, really good player.
Yeah.
and two, that's somebody who, when that opportunity comes up, whether it's on the opening day roster or in April or May, again, Ben Gamel, hey, maybe not the worst fourth or fifth outfielder to have on your bench, but it's just not exciting. So that scenario comes up, I want to see Gilbert get the shot, unless he's in Syracuse and having a hard time adjusting to AAA. Obviously, you don't want to set somebody up where, hey, you're struggling in Syracuse, let's see if you do better up here, you know, in the big leagues. But yeah, it's probably, I mean, I think I was pretty strong on Francisco Alvarez, you know.
Yeah, you were.
His season in Binghamton, but yeah, I think I feel even more strongly about what I saw with Gilbert. So I hope I'm right, and hey, we'll see how it shakes out. If nothing else, this season should be one that presents opportunities to young players.
Absolutely. I still think that I mean, so I was a guest on a new show launching from Fan First Sports Network, the podcast network that we are on, called No Bad Hops. It's a baseball and beer podcast. And I was asked about the move I think the Mets should have made this offseason. And I said a DH. I still feel like without a DH, the Mets are a little bit underwhelming offensively. You know, they're banking on DJ Stewart, Mark Vientos to step up, and I don't know if I'm a believer in that just yet. The only argument I could make for not signing a DH was that if Gilbert comes up, you're going to have to bat Marte / Stewart someplace, right? So having the DH spot available for them is a thing. But I still think that shouldn't be the reason why you don't sign JD Martinez. He's still available. His price has to be dropping every day spring training is going on. Do you have any strong feelings about that?
Yeah. I'm right there with you. I just don't see any downside to signing JD Martinez to a one-year deal. I think that's what he'll get. That's what he got last year,
yep,
which I think was even a little bit surprising, considering. I know he's on the wrong side of 35, which is often not cool among baseball fans, but dude can still hit and hit really well. So I think I said this, you know, in the Amazing Avenue Slack a couple weeks ago, or maybe even just last week, but I'm at the point in the off season that if they were to sign JD Martinez, then I'll get irrationally optimistic.
Yes. Same.
But I think with at least some good reason that, you throw in somebody like that who has that track record, who, I mean, he's not, I don't say, I think it's okay to say that he has not been in decline. I think he's a notch or two down from when he was one of the best hitters in baseball. Mm-hmm. But there has been this slow and steady drop off over the last several years. And that it just adds a significant amount of stability to a lineup that I have tons of confidence in Brandon Nimmo, Francisco Lindor, and Pete Alonso. And I think I'm somewhat optimistic that Jeff McNeil can bounce back again. He's been so up and down on a year-to-year basis. But despite having seen him struggle in two out of the last three full seasons, I think he can bounce back. But if you were to have a middle of the order that had Alonso and Martinez in it, and maybe Lindor too, depending on how you want to build those first two spots in the lineup. But if your 3-4-5 was, or 2-3-4 even, was Lindor, Alonso, Martinez, I think that's pretty formidable. And it seems like the easiest place to get a boost. And also it seems like he'd be extremely easy to trade come July if the season isn't going well. Because somebody will want to bat. And he's got that name recognition and the track record that even if he's not tearing the cover off the ball with the Mets, that's somebody you can trade and bring in a prospect. It's probably not going to be a prospect on the level of the top ones that they got last year. But I just don't see a downside. I know somebody might look and say that, you know, some luxury tax component to it would penalize the Mets in a way that they don't want them to do it. But I feel like the payroll's already so high that I don't think there's really much of a difference in terms of like draft penalties or anything on that side.
Right.
If they were to bring him in, and the amount of money he made in Los Angeles last year by baseball player standards was not like some giant contract. So yeah, I'm with you. I wouldn't say that the Mets are going to win the division and win the World Series if they signed him, but I think I could buy the 80 something wins and make the playoffs projection.
Yes.
Much more easily with him in the fold.
Yeah, I agree with all of that. I think if you add Martinez to the lineup, it's suddenly a much, much deeper lineup. Everything looks a little bit sunnier, and it doesn't block anybody long term. I think it's good for everybody. So make it happen, Mets. And knowing us, hopefully, we're recording this today, it won't come out until tomorrow. Between now and tomorrow, they'll sign JD Martinez. So let's hope that happens.
That'd be great.
Yeah. we are running short on time here, Chris. We're going to briefly talk about Billy Epler, who was essentially suspended for a year from working for Major League Baseball for manipulation of the injured list and specifically falsifying documents involving the injured list. Do we think that he got caught in ways doing stuff that everyone does, or do you think he was doing stuff that no one else does? Because I can't tell by what's been released. But what's your gut telling you?
Yeah, I think he did the same thing that a lot of other people do in the game. I don't have any way of officially knowing that, but yeah, my gut says that he was doing something that is standard practice and overlooked, and then there's a report that would, you know, just this morning John Heyman reported, I think it was Heyman, if not it was somebody else, you know, on the Post sports team there, that it was a Mets employee that had been sort of the whistleblower on that injured list conduct. So look, for all we know, maybe he did go above and beyond and do something that sort of violated the written and unwritten rules of how this all works. But there had been a lot of speculation that maybe a player had made a complaint. And I mean, I guess the reporting makes it sound like another office employee. So I don't know. Maybe he got into an argument or treated somebody poorly, and that person decided to you know, make that report to the league. It's all very bizarre, but
goodness.
I don't know. I feel like it's commonplace among fans to joke about phantom injuries because everybody knows that it happens.
It happens all the time. Yeah.
I mean, the way that reporting read was essentially that because someone filed a complaint and must have had some kind of documentation of those practices, that the league felt like it had no choice but to follow through with investigating and having consequences for it. It's bizarre because we haven't heard anything else. Like, as Mets fans, we knew when Jeff Wilpon was, hit with allegations of sexual harassment, right? Like, it's not like that kind of thing wouldn't come out. And I'm not saying that we know anything about any kind of conduct when it comes to Epler, and certainly not like on that level of the way that, Jeff Wilpon was accused of acting, but it's just bizarre. The good thing is it's kind of wrapped up. So I don't think we're going to really like have to hear about the Billy Epler thing all year. But I don't know, maybe I'm being just too optimistic and hoping that the Mets finally found a way to like not hire the worst of the worst when it came to the way they treated other people. But you can't help but be curious with what happened.
Like, right. Right. What I'll also say about is that, I don't think any of us were huge. And by us, I mean, just sort of our general Home Run Applesauce Amazing Avenue crew. None of us were like super big Billy Epler fans before he came to the Mets. The signing was relatively well received, but not, I would say, over the top well received. I think people thought he was sort of one of the last options. But the thing is that Epler proved himself this past trading deadline. Like he got the Mets a ton of excellent prospects in this deal. And it was I felt at the end of the season, like, all right, now we at least know that Epler can do this part of the job. And now he's going to do none of the job because he's gone. So just another weird turn in the Mets world. But anyway, we are quickly running out of time. So, Chris, what is your music pick for this week?
So, unfortunately, despite 2024 overall having gotten off to a very good start personally, the one sad piece of news was that Wayne Kramer of the MC5 had died while we were in Iceland. So I really cannot say enough about the record that I'm recommending, that I would think and hope that everybody has heard at least once, but that probably isn't the case. But the release from the MC5, Kick Out the Jams, first album recorded live, just blistering, unbelievably good. To me, just everything that you would want in a rock and roll record. And I think the MC5 overall, although screw the Rock and Roll Hall of Fame, it doesn't really like matter in the stature of it all, but like I think they get their due. I think a lot of artists give them the proper sort of respect for being the band that they were and making the music they did and altering what the entire genres of rock music were by doing what they did. But this record, I mean, I still listen to it a lot, but it was something I played over and over and over And as I sort of, entered adulthood and thought about music in just a new way. It is just one of the absolute best. Very importantly, I will say, if you have never heard this record before, or even if you have, please find somewhere else other than Spotify to listen to it. I haven't checked every streaming service, but Spotify has censored, essentially, by removing the beginning of the song Kick Out the Jams, the second track on the record. And Ramblin' Rose, the first track, by the way, has Wayne Kramer on vocals. I drove some people in like my dorm kind of nuts by playing that song over and over and over for like the span of, a semester. But the second track starts with a line that you might be familiar with, whether or not you've ever even heard the record. And it's right now, it's time to kick out the jams, motherfucker. That line is edited out of the Spotify version of this record. So I think, again, I haven't double checked this, but I think on other streaming services, it's not edited. But make sure, if you don't hear that immediately at the end of Ramblin' Rose, stop and resume your listening activities somewhere else. If you cannot find it anywhere, which I would like to think that is not the case, our contact info is here.
Yes.
I can get you the appropriate, MP3 so you can hear the way it's supposed to sound. But I start to finish, I love it. It's to think that this music was being made at the time it was made. It's just incredible. And in the span of, 8 songs, it goes from iconic loud rock to experimental sort of spacey, like heavy psychedelic stuff. There's so much there. One of the most important bands ever and one of my most played records of all time. And it's sad that it came, that one of the most important members of the band is gone. I had the pleasure of meeting Wayne Kramer at, he wrote a book, an autobiography. And he had an event at Strand in New York City. And, I got to meet him, get him to sign the book, talk for like 2 minutes. But that was a really cool thing that I'm glad I got to do. And on top of making just some of the best music ever, after his own personal struggles with drugs and spending time in prison and everything, he dedicated a big chunk of his life over the last few decades, really, to bringing music into prisons. And not just in the form, I think the most famous instance would be Johnny Cash playing at prisons, and there's several records of that. But in the case of Wayne Kramer, bringing instruments in and looking at people who were there as human beings who, might benefit from playing music and getting into all that. So, yeah, rest in peace to Wayne Kramer. Just an absolute legend. And you never need an excuse to put on Kick Out the Jams. But if for some reason you weren't familiar, or if you just haven't listened to it in a long time, that is my album rec for this week.
An excellent rec. I have nothing to add to what you said. Well done. My pick is one. I'm very sorry that the circumstances led to you picking that album, but I was afraid you were going to pick the album that I wanted to pick. So you didn't, so that's good. Last week, Jay Maskus from Dinosaur Jr. released a new solo album called What Do We Do Now? And a lot of times when a frontman from a band releases a solo album, I think, why did you make this a solo album and not just make it a Dinosaur Jr. album? But Dinosaur Jr. has become, especially in its most permanent state, which is its original lineup, but the one that's been active for the last 10 or so years, more than that now, 15 years probably, that lineup has sort of coalesced into a very consistent sound that I really enjoy. This Jay Mascis record somewhat deviates from that. There's much more acoustic guitar. It's much more mid-tempo. There's not Lou Barlow's like snarling bass all over it. And I love Lou Barlow as a bass player. That is not any disrespect to Lou's bass playing. But it's just a different thing. And I feel like a word I would never use to describe Dinosaur Jr., but I would use to describe this record, is sort of vulnerable. I feel like Mascis is singing more emotional and heartfelt and personal lyrics here. I put this on while shoveling nearly 11 inches of snow on Tuesday morning, and it really did make the shoveling go by fast, because the songs are really well written. They're great melodies. There's great playing on them. It's just a very, very nice record. And I shouldn't have to sell you on listening to Jay Mascis' music, so I'm going to leave it at that. What Do We Do Now by Jay Mascis, a brand new 2024 release. Anyway, thank you for listening. We are back with regular podcasts weekly or weekly-ish going forward. So check us out end of every week. You can find Chris on Instagram at Chris McShane. I am on Instagram at Brian Needs a Nap. Go to homerunapplesauce.com for more. And until next time, let's go Mets. Thank you.